Yetzirah, or the evil inclination, as an addiction. And somebody asked me a question, what if a person like one time does something wrong, like one day they don't feel like going to shul or to synagogue, or one day they do something wrong, you know what I mean? They usually are good, but one day they do it wrong, okay? Let's say one day they talk Lashon Hara, gossip. Usually they don't, okay? So the question is that doesn't seem to be an addiction, so it's a question on my understanding of the Yetzirah. I one time heard an interpretation of Moshe's personality. The first thing is when he's set up for the mission to go down to Egypt, he argues with God. Now you'll notice the first six questions God answers, and the seventh one he doesn't. And the reason is because Moshe didn't give a reason. He says, just send it with whoever. Send it by somebody else, not with me. So because he didn't have a rational reason, so God said he'll lower the mission for him. It was like punishment he left the mission slightly lower. Okay. The next time we see that Moshe did something wrong, when he's going down to Egypt, and he has to give a bris to his son, and he decides he has two obligations, one to go down to Egypt and one to do a bris. So he chose the wrong one. He decided, and in those days, if you had a bris, you would have to stay at least 3 days in the place where they were staying, because until he heals. Today you have ambulances and things that could carry you without too much difficulty, but in those days it was a catastrophe. So therefore he would have to push off the mission for 3 days, and so he decided not to do the bris, and God was going to kill him. Okay, at that moment God was going to kill him because he chose the wrong way. Okay? And Zipporah saved him. Okay? The third time you find Moshe slipped up was when God told them to speak to the rock, and he hit the rock. According to another commentary, God told him to hit the rock once, and he hit it twice. Okay, he was under tension. The water didn't come right away. The people were complaining down his back. He was under tension. And so when he spoke to the rock and it didn't happen immediately, or when he hit the rock once and it didn't happen immediately, so he did it again. Either he hit the rock or he hit the rock twice. Under tension, he did the wrong thing and he was punished for that too. Okay? Now, you see a certain pattern with Moshe. Moshe seems to have a conflict with the mission. On the one hand, he doesn't want the mission. But on the other, when he takes it, the mission becomes a very strong tension, and it causes him to make errors in his thinking process. That need to complete the mission becomes so important in his mind that it makes him make errors in the way he makes decisions. You see, that's what we're against emotions in general, that that the emotions affect the way you make a decision. Okay. So what we see is that by Moshe we see a certain pattern in the way he operates. Certain pattern, you see. That pattern, whenever that situation comes up, you see, the tension of the mission, either refusing God, or once he has the mission, he has to complete the mission, becomes so strong that he can't make correct decisions. That is the way emotions work. Okay? Right away we see a proof of this part of his personality, because God wanted to teach him that it's not the mission that's important, but doing the correct act. What was his punishment? the last time when he hit the rock, what was his punishment? He could not go into Israel. Really, Moshe's mission was to take the Jews out of Egypt and to bring them into Israel. But God wanted to show him that that the mission is not the important thing, but doing correct acts is. So he was trying to help him face his emotion of dealing of the way his emotions dealt with the mission. The question is, isn't that a harsh punishment? The answer is that the perfection of the human being is getting your emotions in line with your thoughts. And even to this extent, where God had to stop him to help him deal with that emotion that he had with the mission, so God stopped him from completing the mission for the perfection of the soul. That's what we call perfection, where you undo the, where you deal with the emotion that is affecting your thinking process and where it makes you make errors. Okay? So we see here that the Yetzer Hara is certain patterns that are always there, and it could take years. You see, by Moshe, I mean, this was a problem that he had from all his life, like, and he only dealt with it after the third time. It seems like he dealt with it after that time. But the thing is that you see that you person must deal with their emotions as part of their life, that they have to do within their life. Okay? Now the thing is that you see that that pattern in which you operate, that's a constant. Okay? And you have to first recognize the pattern, and there are different ways of curing it. Okay? That is really the Yetzer Hara. Now the question is, how does that fit in with the idea of addiction? Okay? The answer is that it depends how you define addiction. If you define addiction that is that the situation, in other words, where a situation is constant, in other words, most people look at addiction where there's a constant, you see, but Moshe's addiction, Moshe's problem, didn't show up except only from the time when God gave him that mission. Once he had the mission, in other words, his emotion would have never been awakened. He would have never even known he had a problem if he was never given a mission by God. You see? But once he got the mission, then the emotion was awakened. Once the emotion is awakened, then he has to deal with it. Then God tries to help him deal with it by giving him consequences so that he can see and deal with the emotion. God helps you deal with it, because then you're in terrible pain, you recognize the pain, and then you have to and you see the mistake that you made. Usually afterwards you stop and you see you made a mistake in your thinking process. So then afterwards, that's when you have to start investigating. That's when you have to start investigating the emotion, when you see the mistake that you made, or when you get the consequence. So you know that there is a, that you have to investigate it. Okay? So the question is how you want to define addiction. If you want to define addiction, that's something that is so overpowering that you cannot deal with it, it doesn't matter how much you do it, or you would define addiction by observation. When you see somebody is constantly doing something like smoking, he's always smoking. So you're a person that's constantly drinking. So you realize that's an addiction, you see? But however, it's no different than if your addiction only comes up in certain situations, you are addicted also to acting that way. In other words, the quality is the same. There's some unconscious a problem with certain aspects of the physical world. Sometimes that problem with the physical world, the unconscious problem, the unconscious relationship to the physical, is such that it shows up constantly, or sometimes it shows up every once in a while. But if it shows up every once in a while, it is the same unconscious pattern that has a problem with the way the physical world is. And therefore, and when you do recognize that problem, then you must start dealing with the problem. Okay. Now, there, you have to be careful. There are two types of conflicts, okay? Let's say, for instance, you're raised in a society that smoking is bad, okay? And then you have a conflict whether you should, and all your friends are smoking. So you're in conflict between the authority or the conscience, which tells you not to smoke, and your friends, which are smoking. There, the conflict is not... Again, if you're raised in a society that your parents raised you and the people you know from beginning on told you that smoking is bad, and you're raised that smoking is bad, but then you get into a certain group that they're all smoking and you want to be part of that group, right? So that conflict is a conflict between two parts of the emotions. There's one emotion that tells you not to smoke. There's another emotion that tells you to smoke, okay? But you never figured out which one is right. That's a conflict between two parts of your emotions that is not a conflict with reality. It is possible that a person accepts that smoking is bad not because they really know it. What I mean is they never made a real investigation into smoking. They just accept that that's the way it is. That's the way they were raised, and that's the way it is. So even though their conscience is in line with reality, and they're happy if they do not smoke, they're living a correct life. But the fact is that insofar as your soul is concerned, that is not perfection of the soul. That is not a part of perfection. Perfection is when you do an investigation and the mind tells you what's the right thing, or you train yourself to make decisions by your mind. You constantly study. Let's say it takes 5 years. You study Musar and you study ideas and you study how to make decisions. Or even halacha. You study how the ideas of halacha, and you train your mind how to make decisions in halacha based on the mind. You see? So therefore, once you train to make the decisions by the mind, then an emotion comes in. Then you're in the battle, what we're talking about, like by Moshe. But if it's just two emotions, that's just an inner conflict, then you must deal with that. You must first train yourself. The first stage is training yourself to make decisions based on your mind. If you don't make decisions based on your mind, then you're not in the ballpark. It's just one emotion against the other. So when we're talking about Moshe trained himself to make decisions rationally. That's the first stage of development and perfection of the soul, is to train your mind to make decisions correctly. Then once you do that, then you'll notice, even when you know that it's real, there's certain emotions that don't let you carry out the correct action, or don't let you make the correct decision. You see? At that point, you have to deal with that emotion. But if you're at the stage where there's two emotions before you did the study, so then it's not to deal with the emotions, then you have to deal with the, then you have to train the mind. In other words, something that is correct, sometimes the thing is correct, but how you relate to the correctness has to do with your soul. In other words, let's say a person looks both ways because their mother told them, even when they're an adult, they still love their mother and they look both ways because their mother told them to look both ways. That person is doing the correct act, but insofar as his personality is concerned, he still has an infantile personality, that's the way he relates to the world, through the infantile personality. We hope that a person at a certain stage at the beginning does it because of his mother, and then at another point he does it because he recognizes reality. Okay? So therefore the thing is, a person must train his mind to recognize reality through the mind. What the mind sees, not only the five senses, but to extend the sense of reality to the world of ideas, you see? And then once you do that, so then you start making decisions based on the mind. That's when you have to investigate the emotions where it's affecting your thinking process. Of course, if you have a problem developing, there's a certain emotion that stops you from developing to living a rational life, then you must start out with dealing with the emotions immediately. Right. The question is, can you be rational in an emotional situation? Like, for instance, let's say getting married is definitely a person marries for love. So the question is, where's the rationale come in? You can't marry for rational reasons. You marry for love, okay? The question is, where does the rationale come in? The answer is that after you fall in love with the woman, you should not allow that emotion of love just to blind you and just to go through with it because you fell in love. After you fall in love, you should make an investigation whether this woman will be able to live your value system. Your value system, let's say, is Torah, how far in Torah you have gone, how you want to raise your children. You understand? So who you're going to marry should... For success, you should have similar value systems. Of course, there'll be places where your desire and her desire are different, but then you're going to have to decide how important that is. If it's in a small matter, so then it doesn't matter. So then you can overlook it. But if it's the basis of your value system, then a person should not marry that type of person, whether man or woman, either way. That's the way. In other words, you should fall in love, but the final decision whether you should marry should be based on the mind by investigating your own value system, investigating her value system, and see if that you could live together well. There might be points. There's always points where it's not going to work out exactly, but the essence is the basic value system. We're Proverbs chapter 10, verse 27, and it says, "The fear of the Lord adds days, and the years of the wicked are shortened." And so, since we're adding days to your life, we're definitely not talking about the laws of nature. Because just living the just life will not add days to your life. You could live, we said that it's impossible to mean within the laws of nature, because if it's within the laws of nature, you can't add days. Okay? I mean, a person has a set amount within his genes how long you're going to live, and within the laws of nature, that's not going to work. Okay? So it seems like we're talking about the about God's personal supervision. Okay? The only thing is Ralbag or Gershonides, he says an interesting thing. He says, God will add to man days on the days that appointed to him. In other words, like through his genes. Because of the God's personal supervision, he'll be saved from evil that comes from the laws of nature, and that would cause his death before his time, for his natural time. So he says that, in other words, by adding death, by adding life, Gershonides says that it doesn't mean that we actually add days to your life, but what he does is that there's certain deaths that are premature, for instance, because of war, famines, disease, you know, animals, there's different things that cause death. So God will protect you from that. So Gershonides seems to hold that he's explaining it that way, that God will not add years to a person, no matter how righteous he is. You do find by Samuel, the prophet, that he only lived 52 years, which is pretty short. So I guess in his genes, definitely if God was going to add years, he would definitely add it to Samuel. But you see that since he didn't, it seems like that's what Gershoni is saying, that God will not add years per se to a righteous, but however he'll protect him from those things that will shorten his life. Okay? The life of the wicked means that they will not, I don't know if God will actually destroy them, but they will, they live in the chances of by laws of nature, so they're going to shorten their lives in a few ways. One way is, like we said before, by outside factors. Two is, insofar as they themselves are concerned, their lifestyle will shorten their life. In other words, pressure and stress, that's within a person's control. In other words, how you relate to the outside world is within the human being. He could train himself to remove stress no matter what the situation is. That is possible. So therefore, he could remove the stress in his relationship to the world, you see, and so therefore the righteous will protect themselves in that way too, but that's not outside the laws of nature. That's within his free will, the human being within his free will. But however, the wicked, they're under stress. You notice some of the presidents, they've gotten very young, and within a few years they look really old. I mean, you see that stress really does it. They're under tremendous stress. Now the question is, what is this verse doing in Proverbs? This Proverbs has to do how to make choices on your life and make decisions. This is telling me how God relates to me. Okay, that doesn't belong in the book of Proverbs. It belongs in some other areas of Torah that deal how God relates to the human being, how God interferes to protect the human being or punish the human being. So the question is, what is it doing in Proverbs? The book of Proverbs was written to make decisions in practical everyday life. Okay? Now, one of the decisions that you can make is to get involved in the world of righteousness, because you can reach a level where God will actually relate to you and protect you. So therefore, it is worth it for the person to get involved in the world of righteousness, because it is, in other words, it's teaching you how to make decisions. This is also a decision, okay? So therefore, when you have the knowledge that God relates to you, so then you would make the decision. In other words, the purpose of this verse is not to teach you how God relates to the human, even though we are learning that, but however, it's for the purpose of helping you make a decision to live the life of the righteous. All right, verse 28. It says, the hopes of the righteous is happiness, and the hopes of the wicked are lost. The question is, by hope, what is hope? Hope means that those things that you are working for, it's not just that, you know, idle wishes. I mean, he's talking about things that you want to work for and that you're going to put time and energy into it. So the righteous, what they will work for, according to Rashi, happiness means they will succeed. Therefore, they'll be happy. You see? So he says what they hope for and work for, they'll succeed. But the hopes of the wicked will be lost. In other words, they won't be successful. The question is, what is the difference between the hope of the righteous and the hope of the wicked? What are they hoping for? They're certainly not hoping for the same thing. They're certainly not working towards the same thing. What's the difference in their working? Okay? Now, insofar as the success of the righteous, you could ask the question, well, there are righteous that are not successful. Okay? So the question is, If here they guarantee that if you're righteous, you will be successful. You find a man like Rabbi Akiva that was tortured to death, or there were 10 righteous men that were killed by the Romans, and also by other times there were very righteous men on very high level that were destroyed. Okay? So the question is, what does it mean the hope of the righteous will be successful? There's no guarantee in that. Okay? The answer is that the book of Proverbs only helps you make decisions with the information that you have and where you have the ability to succeed. But sometimes there are things outside of your realm. Yeah, I mean, you're in the war. I mean, it's out of your control. You know what I mean? There's things that are out of your control. There are things that you're unaware of. You make decisions that you're unaware of, and therefore you fail. Okay? So therefore, that realm of where it's out of your hands, that is the realm where we turn to God. And that is not the book of Proverbs. The book of Proverbs, like I said, is a practical book that you make decisions in your world that you know, not in the world that you don't know or in the world that you cannot control. That's not in your ability to control. Okay? Now, therefore, if a righteous fails, there is one of two reasons. Either it's an outside factor, or there's some emotion which he did not perfect. You understand? I mean, like Moshe, late in life, he hit the rock instead of talking to the rock. He made a mistake. You see that there's sometimes you can undo the emotions that make mistakes, that cause you to make mistakes, but however, sometimes it still remains. So insofar as you undo the emotions that don't let you think correctly, and insofar as not that which is outside your realm, then if you think clearly according to Proverbs, then you should be totally successful. Insofar as those emotions that you didn't undo, okay, that will affect your thinking process, and you make a mistake. Like Jacob bought Joseph that coat of many colors, right? So he had a certain emotion, an overly attachment to Joseph, which made him make a mistake, which brought out Joseph's ego, you see, and self-centeredness, right? So you see that he made a mistake. So insofar as that emotion is working, so therefore you'll make mistakes there, and insofar as the laws of nature are those areas which are outside your control, you see, so then it, without those two in all other areas, insofar as you live the life of Proverbs will teach you to know how to make decisions to be perfectly successful. And now also one more point about the righteous. The righteous are only interested in the practical. Okay? They're not interested in being successful for success sake. It's a practical thing. Like, I'm sick, I go to the doctor. I cross the street, I look both ways. So when I make my decisions, the basis of my decisions is based on the practical or some type of pleasure, like the righteous enjoy learning. You understand, they get involved in the world of learning, they enjoy it. So they do it for enjoyment and for practical reasons. And so therefore, that is in the realm of being successful. When it says happiness, it means like you are satisfied that you got that practical, whatever you were working for, You reached it, so you're satisfied. You satisfied that part which were missing. You're working towards a practical thing, meaning there's something missing, okay? I need a certain amount of money, and I make the money, and I work it out that I'm successful. Whatever I need, I work out that I'm successful, so I'm satisfied with my life. And insofar as my enjoyment, so I'm happy with my enjoyments. Yes, Ashi, that is correct. If a person is in conflict, it shows that there's some area of their soul which is not perfected. Right. That's correct. The question is, I want to buy a Mustang or a fancy car, right? Now, the thing is, that is not practical. The reason why I want to buy it is ego. The practical reason for a car is to get from point A to point B. That's it. So, therefore, I might want to get a car that's a heavy car, like an Oldsmobile, a strong car, so if I get in an accident, it protects me. Or I might want to get a small car because it saves on gas. So there's certain practicality, and I have to make these decisions, which is more important to me. Like here would be the heavy car is more expensive to upkeep, smaller, but it's more protective. The smaller car is less protective, but it saves me on gas. What do I need more at this point in my life? You know what I mean? You have to evaluate. But it's evaluating the practical. But if your desire is something that is some fancy car to attract attention, that people should turn their heads, so that is not the ways of the tzaddik. Okay? The tzaddik gets things because of practical reasons.
Okay.
The question is, let's say I want leather seats and a good stereo, not because of public opinion, but because I enjoy, because leather seats makes it feel comfortable, and I enjoy music. Yes, you have the right to enjoy the physical world, and if you enjoy it, that would be a practical decision to get something that you enjoy. Yes. That, in other words, when I talk about an emotional decisions, there's two types of emotions. There's one type of emotion, like jealousy, vengeance. Those are type of emotions, or because of what other people think. Those are type of emotions that is not satisfying, And the thing is, you're never really satisfied because you never can make everybody happy. There's always somebody that's not going to like it. You know what I mean? And you never really satisfy these emotions, and they make you think incorrectly and make you come to incorrect decisions. So those type of emotions, you cannot be happy, and you cannot, and it'll cause you to make decisions that are not successful. You see? But, however, there are certain emotions that we have a right to enjoy. I mean, I like a comfortable chair. I like a lazy boy, or like you said, the interior of a car, certain type of interior that makes you feel comfortable. Okay? Yes, comfort, that type of emotional needs are acceptable as long as they don't reach the level where it becomes so powerful, becomes like an addiction, and you can't think correctly. You understand? As long as it doesn't reach a point where it takes away your ability to think correctly. The question is, that Doug is asking, is let's say a person is involved in learning, or he's involved in perfecting his soul, right? Now there, very few people reach the end goal. I mean, nobody really reaches the end goal. There's always more to learn. There's always more to perfect. I mean, you see, even the forefathers, I mean, they were successful in perfecting their soul, later life. And total undoing of the emotions. And insofar as learning is concerned, they learn to the very end. So the question is, the righteous are not satisfied in the essence of what it is to be righteous. So how could you say he is, you understand? I mean, he's never really satisfied in that area. That is the most essential part to the righteous person, namely his world of learning, his study, and his dealing with his personality to correct any wrong views of life. Okay, so that's a continual process. So he should never come out that he's never satisfied. There, you have to be careful here because in most areas, people are competitive, okay? So the thing is, if you take, let's say, exercise, you notice people that exercise, even though there's nobody else there, they're always checking their watch. They're always comparing how well they did the day before, the day after. Like, it's always a tension of trying to beat your own time and it's competition. I mean, even when you're by yourself, the competition is a way of thinking. It's a certain part of a character trait, the way you operate in competition. But however, there is another reason to go jogging, because it's enjoyable. And it doesn't matter how much you finish. It's just a matter, unless you're doing it for health, so the doctor will tell you exactly how much you should bring up your heart rate. But the thing is that that's also reaches a certain point where it's practical. You don't have to go faster than that. But insofar as the act itself is concerned, there is a certain enjoyment in jogging if you go at a comfortable pace. Or walking, if you walk fast or walk slow. If you walk at your comfortable pace, there is an enjoyment. But the problem is people are constantly forcing themselves to push ahead of where they are. You see? But if everybody went out to do exercise, I think most people, I think, would enjoy it if they just went at a comfortable pace and not worrying about what they did yesterday. One day you're in a bad mood, so you go a little slower. One day you have a little more energy, so you go a little faster. The way you feel. And if you build your lungs up, then naturally you'll go faster because you won't enjoy it at a slower pace. But the purpose is not for competition. The purpose is the enjoyment itself. Okay? Now, when a person starts out in learning, he must start out in a competitive way. In fact, our sages say, competition among the students make you wise, because that's, everybody must start with their motives. You must start with your motives. But after a while, there's a certain enjoyment in the learning itself, and so therefore there's not a drive to finish. It's not a matter of covering pages. It's just to think it through, and at your pace. Some people think faster, some people think slower. You understand, some people think more in depth, some people go less in depth, whatever it is, if each person would think at their comfort level, you understand, you might have to push yourself to sit down to learn sometimes, but when you are learning, you see, there is a certain, there's no rush, it's just enjoying the ideas, you see, and enjoying the process. The same thing with perfecting of the soul. Perfecting of the soul happens to be painful because you're trying to deal with your very personality, trying to change your personality and investigating a part of you which you don't want to look at, the unconscious, which is a part that you don't want to look at. So it has to be painful. And there usually is a goal there, but however, there is also a certain process and there's certain steps along the process which can be enjoyable to a certain extent, okay? But however, if you're only looking for success, then you're right, then it'll be a catastrophe. Okay, but at a certain point, there has to be a relationship to the process that this is the right thing to do, and not just to get results, but the right thing, like for instance, by changing the personality, you might not complete it and you're doing, they have a lot of pain in investigation, but you know it is the right thing to do. You see? So again, you attach it to the act. Okay? It says the hopes and wishes of the wicked will be lost. Okay? The first thing is that many of their hopes and wishes are just a fantasy, like jealousy. If you have jealousy, it's a matter of finding somebody you're going to be jealous of. You know what I mean? You're always jealous of somebody. You could be jealous of God. I mean, you could go in competition with anything or anybody. You understand? If you outdo anybody in this world, then you have... The emotions do not live in reality, and that emotion is not satisfied. Competition or jealousy is not satisfied by winning over one person. You understand? It's a constant. You see, it could never really be satisfied. You see? And all the false emotions that we spoke about, the emotions that cause you to think incorrectly, to make incorrect decisions, you see, all those cannot be satisfied in the physical world, and therefore they are not satisfiable. And secondly, even the way they make decisions in everyday life, because they have these emotions, they will make incorrect decisions that will actually destroy themselves, because the way they think, they'll be making mistakes, so they'll actually destroy themselves. So that's the way that the wicked are, those two ways the wicked are destroyed. One is they can never be successful, because their wishes are something that is impossible to succeed. And two is the way they make decisions, where they will make destructive decisions, so they will fail that way. The question is that if you have so much to do, you have learning and you have perfection of the soul, and you're pushing yourself, because there isn't enough time in the day to get it all done. So the question is that you're just driving yourself again. Okay. The answer is that a person must make an evaluation of how much time his mind is clear in a day, okay, and how much of an outlet he needs to be able to keep a clear mind. Because the essence of Torah is to have a clear mind and to think correctly. So therefore, there's some people that might be able to think for 2 hours a day, and after that, they might as well go out and enjoy life or go to work or whatever, take care of the practical or other things. And they have a clear mind. And other people could put in 18 hours a day and they could still have a clear mind, and they're fine. So the thing is, the person has to first make an evaluation what his needs are. If you're going to put yourself under pressure, then you're not doing the correct thing, because the correct thing is to think clearly, and under pressure you can't think clearly. So therefore you have to deal, if you feel pressure and the pressure is driving you to learn and you cannot, and you're destroying yourself, then you have to learn to undo that pressure. If there's a certain amount of pressure, it's a good lo lishma means an incorrect motive. So there's a certain amount of pressure where you have the incorrect motive that it drives you, but if what's driving you is destroying you, then you must correct that part of your emotions. Either, like we said, either the first step is rationally, to investigate it rationally, that it's wrong and how you're destroying yourself. In other words, to see that you should enjoy the learning and you're not enjoying it. And two, you're destroying yourself. And three, it's affecting the way you think, which means you'll start thinking incorrectly, which is not a good thing, which is against Torah. You see? So a person has to know, there was a man by the name of the Chafetz Chaim. He was one of the greatest leaders a generation ago. I think he died in 1935. And he was in Europe. He had a yeshiva in Europe. And he used to go in the Beis Medrash and close off the lights. Kids wanted to learn till 11, 12 o'clock at night. He used to turn off the lights at night, tell them to go to sleep. One wanted to make sure they get enough sleep. And there was one Rosh Yeshiva from Telz, which is supposed to be a right-wing yeshiva, but I was there at the time when the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Elia Meir Bloch, told the guy that we used to have an hour and a half for lunch, because we dormed there. So we played ball, or we took care of our washing, you know. There was a guy learning in the Beis Medrash at the time. So he went in, he says, no, you can't stay and learn, you have to go out and play ball with the other guys. He sent them out of the Beis Medrash from learning, because he realized that person needs a break. And they have the kids sometimes come in with this fire, and they're driven, and this drive is not a healthy drive. They have to know when to quit. You could overdo that too. So you have to evaluate how much to do. You have to know who you are, what you are. You can't kill yourself. The question is that we know that you can only perfect your soul in this world, and you only have a certain amount of time to perfect it, meaning through learning and perfecting your emotions and getting your emotions in line with that reality. Okay? And now, since you only have a certain amount of time, so there becomes a terrible pressure to complete it. So how do you deal with that type of pressure? Because the only time you can only perfect yourself is in this world, right? So therefore, it becomes a tremendous amount of pressure. That is the question. In other words, if you don't live a balanced life and you drive yourself, then you will not get the learning that you need to get your portion in the world to come. Because the portion in the world to come must come comes from a relationship to learning. And that relationship to learning is you're drawn to learning because of the learning, not some outside factor that what God is going to reward me. The reward of learning is the relationship to learning, not your relationship to the reward of learning. Okay? People that want to complete, that are rushed to complete, is they're attached to the result. Learning itself, and the only way I could relate to learning is when I'm relaxed and I'm not under pressure and my mind could think clearly to remove the problems of life and the problems of all these pressures so that I could think clearly. You see? So therefore, that is the difficulty, is because our emotions are is result-oriented. And you have to change that result-oriented to an action-oriented, where I relate to the act, not to the results. I just do that which is correct. And the results are in the hands of God anyway. It's not in my hands. That's why we pray to God for results. I have to do whatever is possible that I could do. That is the book of Proverbs. That's what Proverbs teaches us. Then I pray to God for the results. But if you're result-oriented, that you can't... Well, everybody is raised that way, and everybody thinks that way, but at a certain point, you have to undo that and relate to the Torah because of the truth and the truth and the correct way of living. That's it. Not because of results. It's not your job to bring about results. It's your job to relate to the activity. The question is that now it puts you in a different type of conflict, because on one part you want to do the result. The other part, you know it's right to do the activity because the activity's safe. So you're caught in that conflict, right? So the answer to that is that you cannot help but live by who you are now. And now you are result-oriented or goal-oriented, so therefore you must make decisions that way. Just try not to destroy yourself, to push yourself so hard that it'll destroy you. Just try to control that. And let the learning affect who you are through the knowledge. The knowledge itself will change who you are. And then, naturally, you'll relate to the activity itself. But that's part of the process of perfecting the human being, or what we call perfecting of the soul. Okay, we're still chapter 10. Verse 29. It says that the stronghold of the tongue, the tongue is a person, according to Rabbeinu Yonah, is a person with no extremes pulling him. He's evenly keeled. Okay? Now the stronghold of the tongue is Derech Hashem, the way of God. And it breaks the doers of sin, those that do sin. The first thing is you have to understand that the way of God, the second half it says, and it breaks the doers of sin. Now the question is, what breaks the doers of sin? What destroys them? The answer is, the subject is the way of God. Right? So the way of God is good for a time, and it's destructive to those that do sin. Okay? Is that clear? In other words, the ways of God is good for the Tom, and it's bad for the Pole of it. So the question is, what's the Derech Hashem? What's the ways of God? And even as it says that the Derech Hashem is mitzvahs, or Torah and mitzvahs, I would say. He doesn't say Torah, he just says mitzvahs. But mitzvos means that, you know, Torah mitzvos is the way of God.
So it's how. So the question is how is the Torah good for a Tom and bad for doers of sin? Now, definitely it's bad for them if they don't keep it. That's for sure. Okay, that's what a doer of sin is a person that doesn't live the life of Torah. But it seems to be that somehow the Torah itself and the mitzvahs itself destroy the doer of sin. Question is how. The question is doers of sin, is it an evil person, or doers of sin is a person that keeps Torah but doesn't do it, for some reason he's doing it in a sinful way? You understand? That's your question, right? In other words, it is possible, we're saying that it is possible that a person could keep Torah and still be called a doer of sin. That's what it seems to be saying. Okay? Of course, that's the Derech Hashem. Derech Hashem is Torah mitzvahs. So it's possible to be doing mitzvahs. It's interesting, the Ibn Ezra says it's only mitzvahs, not Torah. Probably he's right. Doer of sins is a person that does the mitzvahs without the study of Torah. That's probably what it means. In other words, he keeps the Torah, but he doesn't study Torah. He keeps mitzvahs, but he doesn't study the Torah. He keeps mitzvahs, but he doesn't study Torah. That's probably what the Ibn Ezra means. And the question is still, he's not a doer of sins. If he does mitzvahs, he's not a doer of sins. One answer is that he's a doer of sins since he doesn't learn Torah, so then he's a doer of sins because he doesn't know all the mitzvahs, and he doesn't know all the details of the mitzvahs that he does do. He doesn't have a tremendous amount of details of how to do the mitzvahs. He'll miss out on a lot of points. So in that way, he'll be doing sin. That is one way that you could interpret a doer of sins. But the question is, since according to the way we're learning that he's doing the mitzvahs, so then it could be he's doing the details of the mitzvahs. Even though that'd be hard to say. So, yeah, it'd be hard to say that a person that doesn't study Torah is going to know every detail of the mitzvah. It's practically impossible. I mean, that's a practical impossibility. I mean, somebody's going to have to tell him every single detail, because he doesn't learn Torah. He'll have to know every single detail. All right, let's assume he does. Okay, so if he does, so I mean, it's hard to believe such thing. And it'd be so detail in every area, it's hard. I mean, there's a lot of mitzvahs, I don't know, it just seems to be impossible. Okay, the question is, where do you draw the line on the quantity of how many mitzvahs he does, how many mitzvahs he doesn't do, how many details he knows, how many details he doesn't know? Where do you draw the line? It's a good question. Okay, the thing is that let's say, for instance, a person buys a car, okay? Now, some people they buy a car, let's say, just to, so that it should look good, that he should look good when he's driving, or he has, you know what I mean, how it looks. That is not the essence of a car, how it looks or how it makes you look. The essence of a car is to get you from one place to another. Okay? The purpose of religion is to relate you to God. Okay? And all the mitzvahs, its purpose is to help you to get closer to God. But to get closer to God, you must have knowledge of what is close to God. Okay? So the thing is, if I do not have knowledge of who God is and how to relate to God and how the mitzvahs bring me closer to God, okay? If I don't know any of these things, then the mitzvahs, I'm only using the mitzvahs for my own benefit. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, there is in many of the later prophets, they complain against Israel that Israel, it says, what does God want from you? God doesn't want your sacrifices. God wants justice and kindness. In another place, he says, why do you come to Yerushalayim and wear out the street, wear out the stones of my street? Meaning, who needs you to come to the Beis HaMikdash? So the question is, what do you mean? It's in the Torah that you have to go to the Beis HaMikdash. It's in the Torah you have to go three times a year. It's in the Torah that you have to bring sacrifices. So what's wrong with that? The answer is that if you only keep those mitzvahs and you do not keep justice and kindness, it means you're not doing it for Torah. You're using the mitzvahs for some other purpose, some satisfaction that you get out of doing the mitzvahs, but it's not for what the purpose of the mitzvahs are. Person that recognizes Torah studies all aspects of Torah, keeps justice, keeps kindness, and keeps the religious laws, like Shabbos and kosher. But if you only keep Shabbos and kosher, you see, so then it shows that you're not keeping the whole Torah, you're not obeying God, you're not relating to God, but you are just doing it for some personal cause, you see, some personal emotional satisfaction. So therefore, all the acts of the mitzvahs, they become an act of just for your own personal gain. It's not a religious act anymore. You're not relating to God that it's a religious act anymore, but it's only your own personal gain, you see? So therefore, you're really a doer of sins when you take religious articles and religious commandments and use them for your own personal gain. That is a sinful thing. That's not the purpose of Torah. The purpose of Torah is to get you to relate to God. Now, I'd just like to clarify that every person must start out where he keeps the mitzvahs for the wrong reason. But it's through Torah that there is a development. You see? We're talking about a person that keeps the mitzvahs without studying. There is no development. There is no development, so then you're going, then definitely you can't keep the mitzvahs. The only benefit of keeping the mitzvahs is maybe someplace along the line the guy will sit down to learn. You understand? So there's a hope that he might somehow sit down to learn, or if he keeps mitzvahs, maybe his children will get involved in learning and see the truth. In other words, human nature is such that it's impossible to do it for the correct reason. Okay, it's impossible to do it for the correct reason. So therefore, we have no choice. You must do it for the incorrect reason. But however, through the study of Torah, then you will come to the correct reason. But if a person is not studying Torah, he just does the mitzvahs, then that's it. Then he's going to be stuck in that way his whole life. You see, it must go that way. It must start out. So, therefore, you have the right. In other words, the sin is that you're using Torah for your own self-interest. Whatever the motive is, whatever the emotion is that you keep Torah, the purpose of Torah is to satisfy your needs. That is sinning, because that is not the purpose of Torah. You're using Torah for your needs when you really the purpose of Torah is that you should relate to God. It gives you a relationship to God. There's different needs. Some people have a religious need. Some people have a need because their parents raised them that way. They feel close to their parents. You understand? There might be different reasons. Or their society is that way and they want to be part of that society. So there might be many different reasons how it serves your purpose. But however, but that is sinning when you use the Torah for your own self-interests. You see? That is what he's called sinning. It's not sinning in the legal sense. Since we're talking about Mishlei, it's in the perfection of the person, insofar as the person is concerned, he is sinning. Legally, I don't know whether it be considered a sin or not. That's a separate question. But insofar as the mitzvah is concerned, as the relationship to God is concerned, I mean, definitely, that is considered sinning, because you're using Torah for your own self-interest. Now, insofar as the other person is concerned, the person that's evenly keeled, so for him, since he's not drawn to any extreme, so the Torah will help him live his life. If a person like that doesn't have Torah, so then he won't be guided correctly. So if he's not guided correctly, he could harm himself, even though he's evenly keeled. So because he doesn't have knowledge in general, he won't be able to think correctly. But however, he won't know the ideas of Torah. He won't know how to develop. So therefore, he won't gain at all. Person that has an extreme, that's drawn from one part to drawn to an extreme in a certain emotion. So he won't be able to relate to Torah completely, because that emotion will separate him. He'll have to learn to straighten out that emotion. You can become a Tom, evenly keeled, either by birth or by undoing the extreme emotion. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah says later on. So therefore, the evenly keeled person, if he doesn't have Torah, he'll see certain things rationally, but he won't be able to go all the way insofar as perfecting of his soul is concerned. And insofar as he's extreme, as he has qualities of extreme, he could have a certain way.
Yesterday we said that. Yesterday we had the verse. In the verse we explained that that if you are a Tom, a person that is evenly keeled, such a person, learning Torah will benefit him. But if you use Torah and for your own self-interest, it will destroy you. Okay? What we didn't answer yesterday is how it will destroy the person of that has the emotions. That we didn't explain. In other words, where you relate to Torah by self-interest, it can destroy you. Question is how. The answer is that you notice that emotions attach to the particulars. Okay? You attach to the particulars. And when you attach to the particulars, you cannot, in other words, your emotions relate to that particular object, and you review that particular object the way your emotions look at it. In other words, your emotions create a certain framework. Your emotions create what the facts mean. In other words, like if you take an extreme case, a psychotic looks at a tree and says, the tree is going to kill me. You understand? And so that's, in other words, it creates things. Now, to a certain extent, we also create things in the physical world without realizing it, but it's not psychotic, but it's a natural, but a certain sense of reality keeps us within a certain framework. So the thing is that when you're totally from the emotional point of view, so then you're going to look at the particulars and relate to the particulars based on your feelings. You see? And we're supposed to look at the world based on the way Torah looks at the world. We're supposed to, through the study of Torah, we're supposed to look at the world the way Torah views the world, and that's supposed to be an intelligent, and we're supposed to see how that is the real world, and that's the real way of looking at the world. Let me explain a little better, okay? The thing is that when you keep halacha, you must keep halacha in a certain framework. It has to be in other words, the question is, why are you keeping halacha? There's something motivating you to keep halacha. You could keep it in the emotional framework, or you could keep it in the framework of Torah itself, namely the hashkafa, or the philosophical part of Torah. Okay, or the hashkafa. Hashkafa means a view. There's a certain view of life that the hashkafa brings across. Now that view of life, then when you keep halacha, you'll keep halacha in that framework.
You see? So there's two frameworks in keeping halacha. There's the emotional framework in keeping halacha, and then there's the hashkafa, the view of life that Torah dictates, and when you see the ideas clearly, you start looking at life this way, so then that causes you to relate to halacha in that framework, in the Torah framework. Now, the emotional framework, once you relate to it in the emotional framework, then you're dealing with it in, like, particulars. You're only using it based on your own emotions. The emotions, we know from many discussions, that affect the way you make decisions and the way you think. It could affect, in many ways, how you make decisions, you see? And since emotions, by definition, has to be self-centered, I mean, so then you're going to look at life from a self-centered type of view. The whole religion becomes a self-centered type of view. You see, in other words, how could it help me, and what could God do for me, and I pray for what God could do for me. What about my relationship to God? That's a different, see, that they don't. That's not self-centered. Self-centered is only what I get out of it, you see. While the correct way of looking at it, the correct way is when you look at it through the world of ideas, you see, and through the world of reality and truth, you see, so then that's a different framework, and you train to think correctly and to live within reality. Once you learn to live within reality, and the whole framework in which you operate is based on reality, so then you'll be highly successful. First of all, in your decision making, and two, in your relationship to God. The question is one selfish and one unselfish? The answer is it doesn't make a difference. I'm not talking about selfish. I'm talking about two different views. One is self-centered, and one is objective. It's a relationship to the physical world. One comes through reality, through the physical world, through the study of Torah, an objective study of Torah to see it logically, and one is just a view of self-centeredness, the egocentricity of the emotions. We have one more question. If this is true, then what about you must do things, when you first start out studying Torah and relating to the Torah, you must relate to it in your own framework and in your own motives and your own drive, so therefore you must relate to Torah that way. You have no choice, you see? So the question is, the person is already doing it in a bad way. You understand? The answer is, it's true that when you do it that way, it is, in other words, we allow you to do the incorrect way because you have no choice. There is no choice, so we have to give you a license to operate in that manner. See, we must give you a license to operate in that manner. The question is whether you pull out at a certain point, recognize that it's time to pull out and what's necessary for you. Sometimes you can pull out naturally. Certain people don't pull out naturally. But if you're not pulling out naturally, so then there must be a problem, then you must learn how to deal with that problem. You see? So therefore, to deal with that problem, then you must undo the problem so that you could relate in the correct manner. You see? In other words, you have no choice. You must start out that way. But at a certain point, the incorrect approach must be removed. Must be removed. Whether it'll be removed through your study of Torah, whether you have to deal with certain emotions that's stopping you from the development, so then that's a separate question. That's a detail in the particular person. But however, the lo lishma, or incorrect approach, must be at some point removed. The question is when in Torah do you take things literally, and when do you interpret them as a metaphor? That's the question. The answer is the same God that created the physical world created Torah. In the physical world, whatever I perceive with my five senses, I take literally unless I find that there's a contradiction. In other words, if I see railroad tracks coming together, then I walk over to where they came together and I see they're not together, so there's a contradiction. Then I have to start interpreting either the physical world or the way my eyes see things, but it's based on a contradiction. So whenever you find facts that are contradictory, then you must explain the facts. Now the same thing in Torah. In Torah, wherever there's a contradiction, then either we accept both things as facts and we subdivide, okay, and we give a subdivision, just like in the laws of nature, we do the same. And sometimes you can't subdivide, but you must make one into a metaphor. How to know when to subdivide, when to put one into a metaphor? The way to tell is like this. If the fact that's in question is totally contradictory to either the laws of nature or to the philosophy of Torah, so then it has to be a metaphor. Like, for instance, the Song of Songs, a love poem, is not the philosophy of Torah. It shouldn't be part of Torah. So therefore, it must be totally a metaphor. But however, when there are two facts, they both could be true, okay, that's when you have to subdivide. The question is like the splitting of the Red Sea, that's contrary to the laws of nature, okay? So how come we accept the Red Sea as a miracle? The answer is that we do hold that God could suspend the laws of nature, and therefore we accept it as a miracle. And you have to know when to accept the miracle and when not to accept the miracle. Now the question is when you're formulating your philosophy of Torah, so then at that point there is nothing basic to the philosophy, you're formulating it and you have all these facts. The answer is that we do have an oral law. We accept the oral law. And the oral law many times tells us which is basics. Like the Rambam says that the 13 basic principles of faith, that is must be acceptable. Now, if you come across a fact that seems to contradict the 13 basic principles of faith, then I can't take that literally. Okay. We're doing chapter 10, verse 30. It says the righteous will not be moved forever. And the wicked will not dwell in the land. Okay? The questions are, what does it mean forever? What does it mean they'll be not moved? And what do you mean the wicked will not dwell in the land? Where else are the wicked going to dwell? That's where they dwell. They dwell in the land. Everybody dwells in the land. Okay? Right. Now, the thing is, Baal Yimot, that he cannot be moved, means that it's firm. That the tzaddik is firm in his convictions and lifestyle. Okay? Forever, Rashi says forever, that he says he cannot be moved, right? Rashi says it doesn't mean that he can't be moved forever. It's not translating it that way. He says that when he is moved, it is not moved forever. In other words, when his convictions or is somehow broken or his actions are somehow incorrect, so he will not be moved away from it forever. Okay? It'll only be for a short time. And okay. The question is also, what is there about the tzaddik that when he fails, it won't be forever, it'll be for a short period? And what is there about the wicked that he won't be able to dwell in the land, whatever dwell in the land means altogether, that you can't dwell in the land? Okay. These are the questions. According to Rashi, you'd read the verse, The righteous, when they are moved, they are not moved forever. And the wicked will not dwell in the land. That's the way Rashi is learning the verse. And the question is, what does it mean not dwell in the land? Okay, that's the question that we'd like to discuss now. Okay, the thing is like this. If you take the extreme case, like let's take a psychotic, okay? Now, a psychotic lives in his own world. He's living, physically, he's living in the physical world. But mentally, he's living in his own world. He's not living in this world. And the way he makes the decisions is he's making decisions based on his own world, and he's not making decisions based on reality. You see? So therefore, what it's saying is the wicked cannot dwell in the land, meaning they're living in a totally different life. Okay? We have to describe what the difference is. What's the difference between the wicked and this? The wicked are not psychotic, so the question is, in what way are they not living in the land? Right. Since Mishlei is dealing with the subject of decision making, right? So the thing is, the question is, how do you make your decisions? Okay? There are certain decisions that is based on a certain reality, and there's decisions that are not based on reality. I'll give you an example. The difference between an animal, the instincts of the animal, and the emotions of the human is the instincts of the animal guide them to the survival of the species. The emotions of the human, if he follows his emotions, it leads to self-destruction. Okay? For instance, a person is making cars, okay? Now, the thing is that he doesn't want to put in pollution devices to protect the air because of his greed, right? But since he is living in this world, simultaneously that he's making money, he's also causing pollution, which is causing him and his family to get sick and to get all types of diseases, you see? So in that way, the emotions are very destructive, self-destructive. When we say that on purpose, we say that the greed, they want to make the money, and they close off their mind to the way that they're being destroyed. They don't recognize that. They close that off. But simultaneously that they're striving to satisfy one emotion, they blind themselves on the destruction when they go too far in that emotion. Okay? But the question is, what about the evolutionary process? Animals were not, perfect, right? The answer is that there are two types of animals. Both of them operate for the survival, but one happens to be stronger. In other words, the instinct is not self-destructive. One of them is a better model animal. So the better model animal sticks around, and the other one fades away. Okay? But it's not that the first one was self-destructive, it just wasn't perfectly made. It's not that it's not perfectly made, it's good for the way it is, but there is a better model. You understand? It has better things about it. But the human is not that it's just that it's a weaker model, that you get a better model. The human is self-destructive. The weaker model of the animal is not that it's self-destructive. It's not going to operate in ways that are self-destructive. It'll operate the best with what it has. The human being is self-destructive with the qualities that it has. It operates in such a way that it's self-destructive. It's different than what evolution has in mind. The original animal, the first type, is not self-destructive. It's just not the best in this situation. the human being can do the correct thing and live well, but it decides to live to satisfy another emotion, which is destructive, and close off the ideas that will benefit him. In other words, there's certain things that I don't have, like. For instance, let's say, earthquake. You know what I mean? Or the fires in California that are happening now. It's out of my control. You understand? I don't have the powers to control it. That's a weakness in the human that it's not. It's the type. That's it. These are the facts of life. But so therefore, I am lacking certain qualities to do certain things. That would be equal to the beginning parts of evolution. That's a good way of putting it. Without outside influences, the animal will do the best for the species that he can. The human will self-destruct himself and the species. The only way the animal will be destroyed is by outside influences. And the human could also be harmed by outside influences that's beyond his control. But insofar as the drive is concerned, the beginnings of evolution, they did the best with what they had. But the human being takes the best that he has and uses it for self-destructive purposes. So he's not living on the land. He's not living in this world. He's not living in reality. The question is, what's the definition of the righteous and the wicked here? Okay? Now, according to this pasuk, by define righteous and wicked according to this pasuk, okay, then the righteous is the people that recognize truth and reality and live by it, while the wicked blank out truth and reality so that they could be guided by their own desires, okay, which is self-destructive. If you don't recognize truth or reality, then by definition you're going to have to be a fool or wicked or both. The question is, who's worse off, the fool or the wicked, okay? Now, the fool is destructive to himself. The wicked is destructive to himself and society. So therefore, the fool is doing less damage than the wicked. In other words, the fool and the wicked are both in the same category, insofar through the eyes of this verse, that they're both self-destructive. Okay? In that way, they're both equal. You understand? But however, the wicked goes out to harm others. In that way, he does more damage, because not only does he damage himself, but he damages others. But the fool only damages himself. The question is by Gemara. Sometimes they give when they explain the Gemara, they give a crazy case. You understand? It's so strange that it's possible that the case might never happen. It practically could happen, but it practically might never happen. So why do they use these type of cases? The answer is that the purpose of the case is to show you a concept, definition, or theory, a certain idea, and this case points to that idea in the best possible way. In the same way as in the universe, when we analyze the universe, there's certain questions, we have certain facts that are contradictory, so they give a theory that explains it. So Aristotle, with the facts that he had, gave a theory that explained the physics of his time. But then when they started investigating, they got new facts. They showed that Aristotle's theory does not work. So since his theory does not work, along came Newton and gave a new theory to explain the new contradictions and the new information that they had, to explain the new theory, to explain how it all works together. What happened was that we got new information and there were questions against Newton's theory, and again the facts were contradictory, so along came Einstein and explained it. Okay? So the theory or concept or definition explains how these facts work. You see? That is why they give a strange case in Gemara. Now the next question is that sometimes you find in the Gemara a contradiction and they create a new case. Okay? Now, I mean, what, they changed their mind? First they looked at it one way, and then they said changed their mind, they looked at it another way. The answer is that the Torah was written in general form. The best example, again, is the physical world. When you look at the physical world, you accept your five senses. But then what happens is you find contradictions. When you find contradictions, you have to subdivide. You have to start subdividing to say this is, it works this way here and it works that way there. It works in different cases that way. Okay? So therefore, the same thing here, the Gemara and the Chumash wrote the Chumash was written, and the facts of the Gemara, the Mishnah was written in general statements, but these statements many times contradicted themselves, so they have to subdivide, and they wrote it specially that way, so you should see the contradiction, then you'll subdivide and you'll get that concept. Okay? Because, and you really see that the same God that created the universe, and that you investigate the universe that way, is the same God that created the Torah, and you investigate the Torah the exact same way. You start out superficially, you accept the facts the way they are, then you have questions. Sometimes certain questions have to be subdivided. You have to know when and where. Sometimes they have to be subdivided, and sometimes they're not to be subdivided, but it needs a concept, and you have to know when and where, when to subdivide, when a contradiction leads to a subdivision, and when a contradiction leads to a new theory or new concept or new definition. Okay, we're doing verses, chapter 10, verse 31 and 32. It says, the mouth of the righteous utter wisdom, and the tongue of contradictions is cut off. The next verse says, the lips of the righteous know his will, and the mouth of the wicked are opposites or contrariness. That's two verses. The difference between the first verse and the second verse is the first verse tells the consequences of a certain lifestyle. The second verse speaks about the causes of what brings about these consequences. Okay, so we'll have to do the second verse first and then come back to the first verse. So the second one says, the lips of the righteous know his will. So Rashi says there are two wills that we're talking about. The will of God and the will of people. Okay? He knows both of them. And the mouth of the wicked is contrariness. Okay? We have to know what that means. Okay. Okay. There are two realities that a person has to be involved in. One reality is the laws of nature and how to deal with nature in general. Or insofar as God is concerned, that's God's creation. But it's also God's personal supervision, how to get to work according to that system based on God's personal supervision. Okay? That's one reality. There's another reality, namely people. Okay? People act and speak in a certain way, not always their true personality. The true personality of a person is not always known to the person himself. And if you relate to a person on a superficial manner, so then, in other words, you don't really understand how they operate, so then you're going to make terrible mistakes in dealing with people, because you don't know who they really are, so you're going to make terrible mistakes in dealing with them. You must be able to define who a person is, what makes them tick and what makes them operate, so that you could deal with it correctly. Okay? So therefore, there are two wills that we're talking about. We're talking about God's will. God's will is the laws of nature and the way he relates to the humans based on good and evil. That's God's personal supervision. And then also, since you have to deal with people, and people are complex, if you relate to them on a superficial level, you'll make terrible, terrible mistakes, and it'll come out the incorrect thing. You'll operate incorrectly. And in fact, the second half of the pasuk tells us about it. It says, because the mouth of the wicked is contrary. In other words, sometimes consciously he'll say things that he really doesn't mean, and many times he'll say things that he doesn't realize why he's saying it. He thinks one thing and the motive is another, because there is a part of you which is unconscious. Unconscious means that you're not aware of this part, and yet it plays has an effect upon your life. Okay? So therefore, that is the second half of the pasuk, and the first half of the pasuk says that, the first pasuk, the pasuk 31, speaks about the result.